Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 24th of March 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode 70 and we are currently looking at the end of the Saxon period and the brief beginning of the Danish period, particularly concentrating on Canute the Great. And we're also going to take a look at Edmund Ironside in this episode. And this particular period in history is probably going to take up two or three, maybe even four episodes. We've got quotes from Wikipedia and we've also got quotes from Sharon Turner, which have been given to us by one of my amazing co-hosts. We have two co-hosts here with me today. We have Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community and we have Truthvids from truthvids.com. And it's Truthvids who has provided these Sharon Turner notes. Truthvids, how are you doing, sir? How is life treating you?
Yeah, all good. I'm looking forward to this because Sharon Turner, he was very pro, English, pro-Saxon. So it's English. It's interesting to see his view on Canute, who was actually a foreigner, a Dane, because Sharon Turner really thought highly of Alfred. He really liked Alfred the Great. So here we'll see what he thinks of Canute the Great as well, right?
Well, it's also really good to hear from another patriotic author. Sharon Turner was, as you pointed out there, he was a big fan of the Anglo-Saxons and his Saxon heritage. Patriarch, how you doing, sir? Welcome back to the show. How is life treating you?
Hi, Sven. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, everything's going well and looking forward to another episode.
Yeah, well, as I say, we're going to go back. At the end of the last episode, we started talking about Canute's mother and a little bit of his childhood and the Christianization of Denmark. And today we're going to go back a little bit before that, probably about 15 years, 20 years before that, I think. And we're going to start with some quotes from Sharon Turner, referring again to this awful massacre, the St. Bryce's Day massacre that we briefly covered with R.W. Morgan's quotations on it. And this is what Sharon Turner has to say about it. The year 10,002 has become memorable in the annals of crime by an action as useless as imbecility could devise and as sanguinary as cowardice could perpetrate. On the day before St. Bryce's festival, every city received secret letters from the king, commanding the people, at an appointed hour, to destroy the Danes there suddenly by the sword, or to surround and consume them with fire. This order was all the more atrocious, as the Danes were living in peace with the Anglo-Saxons. The expressions of Malmesbury imply even an endeared amity of connection, for he says with correct feeling that it was miserable to see everyone betray his dearest guests, whom the cruel necessity made only more beloved. To murder those we have embraced was a horrible idea, congenial only to Ethelred and his counsellors. The tyrannical command was obeyed. All the Danes dispersed throughout England with their wives, families, and even youngest babes were mercilessly butchered. So dreadful was the excited spirit that Gunhilda, the sister of Svein, who had married an English earl, had received Christianity and had voluntarily made herself the pledge of Danish peace, was ordered to be beheaded by the infamous Edric. Her husband and boy were first slain in her presence. She foretold the vengeance which would pour upon the English nation, and she joined her lifeless friends. So this is interesting to see. Sharon Turner, who is a big fan of the Saxons, he is similarly just as disgusted at this act as R.W. Morgan, who is obviously a big fan of the Britons. And we can see here, nobody was spared. And even Sharon Turner is saying here that they were on good terms with the Danes at this point. They were living in peace with the Danes. I guess it was just this Dane guilt had just become too much for them. They didn't want to pay it. And it really doesn't look very good about Ethelred, does it? Ethelred's personality and his character, that he was the one that did this. And also interesting here, we have this mention of this infamous Edric character, and I think he's going to turn up. He's going to turn up again. He was the one that actually beheaded this princess. So that's regicide, really. It doesn't matter that it's a Danish princess. It was regicide. It's just a horrific thing. A very big black stain on British history, I think. Truthfords, what are your thoughts on the massacre of the Danes?
Yeah, it was horrible. And here you can see also the English Earl would have been beheaded because obviously he wouldn't go along with his wife and children being, you know, massacred. So they even killed, I imagine, some of their own people just in case that they, you know, would have joined up with Cnut for vengeance. And you can understand why Cnut and Sven came back because his own sister was killed. So, of course, there's going to be a lot of British people killed for this. So it was really stupid in that sense as well, right?
So there was a blood feud that was the result of this. Literally, it was his sister that was murdered, not just all of these Danes, part of his extended family, but part of his immediate family as well. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's quite brutal, isn't it? And what's more surprising is that this took place while they were kind of, Christianity was quite well established and there was, you know, peace amongst them. It's like they kind of reverted for a time to the tribal, roots, that side of Christianity, and they just pure anger and rage kind of came upon them. So I just wonder why, really. I mean, obviously they didn't want to pay it, but did they think that it would send a message to Denmark and the, they just wanted to cut ties completely?
Yeah, it's like, what about the long-term consequences of this? I mean, it's just very short-sighted, isn't it? I mean, perhaps it was just an emotional thing, right? We've had enough and just lashing out. But it does seem as if it was planned. You know, if these orders were sent out, these secret orders, it wasn't like something was just the final straw and there was a burst of attack in one area and then it lit the fires of rebellion all the way through the country. It was planned. It was premeditated. At the appointed hour, they did this. Absolutely atrocious. Well, never was such a nation plunged into calamity so unnecessarily. The means were abundant of exterminating Svein and such invaders if a government had but existed with whom its people would have cooperated. The report of Turketal to Svein gives us an impressive picture of the English condition. A country illustrious and powerful, a king asleep, solicitous only about women and wine, and trembling at war. Hated by his people, and derided by strangers. Generals envious of each other, and weak governors ready to fly at the first shout of battle. So this is what happened afterwards, basically, after this massacre of all the Danes. He's saying they had enough people there to fight against Svein, but they just didn't have the courage. Quite pathetic, really. And this is what happens when you have a king that doesn't set a good example. And they're saying here, the king's asleep, solicitous only about women and wine and trembling at war. What good is a king like that? You need a king that is going to be the very best example of your people that there is, who is going to set a high moral example for the people to follow and that they can rally around and that is going to lead them into battle in times of war and that is going to be the most moral and upright of them in times of peace, like Alfred the Great was. And instead, we have the opposite here. We have this dreadful character, Ethelred, massacred all of these Danes, and afterwards it tells us here all he was interested in is women and wine. No interest in setting a good example whatsoever. What do you make of this quote here, Truefids?
Yeah, well, that's always the good and downside of having a king. When he's a good king, your country is very well run, but when you get a bad king, unfortunately, this is what happened, right? He's meant to be protecting you from invasions. And he was actually married to the daughter of Normandy, right? Richard. And he was actually constantly having affairs. So this also caused friction with Normandy as well. And but basically, it was just a sad state, right?
Yeah, and I think when after this as well, I mean, he soon got kicked out of the country as well, as we'll get to in a bit. Petra, any thoughts on this dreadful state of the nation?
Yeah, so I'm assuming obviously it came about because of the king, obviously under a leader like Alfred. This thing probably would never have happened. So, it obviously happened because of this king. But I wonder why this kind of king came about, and maybe it was because of the sort of relative peace that was established before him, and they kind of rested, well, not necessarily rested on the laurels, but they maybe not experienced such peace, and for a long time that they, I don't know, started to, you know, the devil makes work of idle hands, as the saying goes, and maybe they just started to become more corrupt in their nature, and over time, and channeled it elsewhere, channeled it towards themselves as opposed to other necessary enemies.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there. It's that phrase, isn't it? Hard times create strong men. That was at the time of Alfred the Great. Strong men create good times. That was Alfred the Great. And then good times create weak men by the time we get to Ethelred here. So, yeah, that's a good point you bring up there, I think. Next, we'll move to Canute's childhood. Some hint of Canute's childhood can be found in the Flateyjarbók, a 13th century Icelandic source that says he was taught his soldiery by the chieftain Thorkell the Tall, brother to Sigurd, the Jarl of Jomsburg, and the legendary Joms Vikings, as their stronghold on the Volin off the coast of Pomerania. His date of birth, like his mother's name, is unknown. Contemporary works such as the Chronicon and the Encomium Emma do not mention this. Even so, in a Knutsdrapa by the skald Uttar Svarti, there is a statement that Canute was of no great age when he first went to war. It also mentions a battle identifiable with Svein Forkbeard's invasion of England and his attack on the city of Norwich in 1003-1004, after the St. Brice's Day massacre of the Danes by the English in 2002. If Canute indeed accompanied this expedition, his birth date may be near 990 or even 980. If not, and if the skald's poetic verse references another assault, such as Svein's conquest of England in 1013, 1014, it may even suggest a birth date nearer 1000. There is also a passage of the Encomiast, as the author of the Encomium Emma is known, with a reference to the force Canute led in his English conquest of 1015 to 1016. Here it says that all the Vikings were of mature age under Canute the king. So he's saying he was at a very young age when he first went out on his first battle there. A description of Canute appears in the 13th century Icelandic Knytlinga saga. Canute was exceptionally tall and strong and the handsomest of men, all except for his nose that was thin, high-set, and rather hooked. He had a fair complexion and a fine, thick head of hair. His eyes were better than those of most men, being both more handsome and more keener of sight. So that's basically what we know about his early life there. Do you want to make any comments on that, Truefitz?
Yeah, you can see in those days that the son just accompanied the father in war. You know, even if he was, 14 or something, that was how they became a man. And as you said, tough times make strong men. You can see that Knut was hardened like steel and made into a man, whilst Ethelred wasn't, right? He just had a kingdom. There's no records of him fighting in battles, really. So he became soft and just interested in, you know, sleeping around and drinking wine, and the kingdom was crumbling, whilst Knut was a very strong, powerful man, right?
So he was battle hardened. I mean, if it says here that he was born in 10,000 and then there was, or 1000 rather, and then he was leading his English conquest in 1015, 1016, then, I mean, he was, 15, 16 years old when he was going out on this battle, 13 years old when he was going out with King Svein and the battle back then. So of a very young age to be going out to war, I guess that would have been what happened at that time. It would have been young men, what we would consider today young, very young teenagers, that were the warriors. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, what I find interesting is, like you say, about the, you know, young kings going off to war and being battle hardened and that. I mean, a lot of them tend to survive, don't they? So I do wonder, you know, if they've been given some particular advantages So, I mean, they likely train a lot and get given the best training. You know, they don't have to do much with their time, maybe, you know, learn things, but they can probably focus on training and from the best teachers, and they're probably given the best armor. And perhaps they're kind of given the best positions in war as well, or to basically increase their chances of survival. So although they'll get the, you know, their hands dirty, I think they get given the best possible advantages as well for war.
And I think they had good surgeons back then as well. I mean, you know, I was reading something the other day about the Celts having tree panning, to like cut a hole in the head to relieve the pressure in the brain, and they were able to do that in something like 1000 BC. And the Egyptians have they were replacing teeth in, I think, 1000 BC with gold teeth. You'd imagine that these Vikings probably had good surgery skills. I mean, we heard about that Viking king who didn't have any legs. I mean, there must have been a lot of maimed people, and the surgeons would have stitched them up, I suppose, and they would have carried on fighting. So I think they would have had a lot of medical skill. And I would also had an understanding of the way that the human body worked from so many massacres that they've been involved in, I think. Well, hardly anything is known for sure of Canute's life until the year he was part of a Scandinavian force under his father, King Svein, in his invasion of England in summer 1013. Canute was likely part of his father's 1003 and 1004 campaigns in England, although the evidence for that is not firm. The 1013 invasion was the climax to a succession of Viking raids spread over a number of decades. Following their landing in the Humber, the kingdom fell to the Vikings quickly, and near the end of the year, King Ethelred fled to Normandy, leaving Svein Forkbeard in possession of England. In the winter, Svein was in the process of consolidating his kingship, with Canute left in charge of the fleet and the base of the army at Gainsborough in Lincolnshire. So that's basically within 10 years they've managed to drive King Ethelred out after this St. Brice's Day massacre. On the death of Svein Forkbeard, after a few months as king, on Candlemas, Sunday 3rd of February 1014, Harold succeeded him as King of Denmark, while the Vikings and the people of the Danelaw immediately elected Canute as king in England. However, the English nobility took a different view, and the witting Gamot recalled Ethelred from Normandy. The restored king swiftly led an army against Canute, who fled with his army to Denmark, along the way mutilating the hostages they had taken and abandoning them on the beach at Sandwich in Kent. Canute went to Harold and supposedly made the suggestion that they might have a joint kingship, although this found no favour with his brother. Harold is thought to have offered Canute command of his forces for another invasion of England on the condition that he did not continue to press his claim. In any case, Canute succeeded in assembling a large fleet with which to launch another invasion. So it wasn't taken as immediate that Canute would be the king in England, and the Saxons wanted to get Ethelred back, and the Danes, obviously, they wanted to have Canute, and his brother has taken the kingship in Denmark. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, so Harold was his elder brother, so that's why Canute had to ask him if he'd want to share it, and Harold said no. Back to England. I'm not sure if all the nobles, it was because they felt patriotism and wanted Ethelred back. It might just be because he was weak and they could manipulate him and it would serve them more, whilst if Canute came, he would probably put his own people in power and they would lose their land. It might be more of that. Why they wanted Ethelred back, even though he'd been a terrible king so far, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you tend to assume, oh, it must be ethnic solidarity. That's why the Saxons wanted the Saxon king back. But as we've seen, the Welsh were happy to accept the Saxon king over them, Alfred the Great. And I think the Saxons were happy with the Danes at some point. So it may not have been the ethnic solidarity. It could have just been, yeah, that he was very easily to manipulate. We don't really know about the power that these lords had at this time. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Well, I just wonder if it's all interconnected with the original disdain for the Dane tax. If that was kind of the initial factor for the division, and then it kind of things sort of developed from there.
Yeah, if they're still having to pay this protection money, essentially, is what it is, isn't it? That's what the Dane Guild was. So they may have still been upset at that. May have still been paying it. I mean, it doesn't tell us. I should imagine they were still paying it. Well, among the allies of Denmark was Boleslav I the Brave, the Duke of Poland, later crowned king, and a relative to the Danish royal house. And this is interesting because you don't really tend to hear that much about Poland before this point, and they have a lot of mythical histories that people will say that they're mythical or they're legendary kings. But we have proof here that there was these kings of Poland, and they were linked with the kings of Denmark, the Nordic folk, and their royalty was seen as equal to the royalty that we had in Northern Europe. So Boleslav I, the Brave, the Duke of Poland, he lent some Polish troops, likely to have made a pledge to Canute and Harald Hardrada, when in the winter they, quote, went among the Wends to fetch their mother back to the Danish court. She had been sent away by their father after the death of the Swedish king, Eric the Victorious, in 995, and his marriage to Sigrid the Haughty, the Swedish Queen Mother. This wedlock formed a strong alliance between the successors to the throne of Sweden, Olaf Skotklonung, and the rulers of Denmark, his in-laws, and Swedes were certainly among the allies in the English conquest. Another in-law to the Danish royal house, Erika Hakonarsson, was the Earl of Lade and the co-ruler of Norway with his brother Svein Hakonsson. Norway having been under Danish sovereignty since the Battle of Svolder in 999. Erika's participation in the invasion left his son Hakon to rule Norway with Svein. In the summer of 1015, Canute's fleet set sail for England with a Danish army of perhaps 10,000 in 200 longships. Canute was at the head of an array of Vikings from all over Scandinavia. The invading army was composed primarily of mercenaries. The invasion force was to engage in often close and grisly warfare with the English for the next 14 months, and practically all of the battles were fought against the eldest son of Ethelred, Edmund Ironside, who we will talk a little bit about later, who certainly had a completely different character to his father. But I think what we can see here is you had all these loyalties all the way across Scandinavia and also with the Poles. So where it's saying that these were mercenaries, they were all people that were allied with the Danes. And you can see that there's links between Norway, Denmark and Sweden. They've already got the makings of this Nordic empire, basically, that they had there between the various Scandinavian countries. Any thoughts on this, Trefids?
Yeah, you can see that the English king really was fighting three countries at once, right? It was a whole coalition. So I mean, that the odds are definitely stacked against him, and they're sending just basically men, warriors, that they don't have to defend anything. You know what I mean? So it was always hard for the English to try and rally men, you know, stop them farming and form up some kind of military force to defend. You know, because they weren't necessarily promised plunder like all these Vikings were for participating, right, or to rule over land, et cetera, et cetera.
That's rather like a world war at this time, isn't it? All of these countries uniting against England. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I wonder what their interest in England was, or was it just the fact that they were the last to sort of join in? From the Western nations within Europe, they were probably the last to be amalgamated into the under the more Nordic kingship.
Yeah, and I think England was probably fairly wealthy at this time as well, and they were all getting this money from this Danegeld. And I should imagine they wanted to expand the empire. If they already had Scandinavia, then they wanted to take England. And I think they also had parts of Ireland as well. So they were sort of working their way across there, across the North Sea and across St. George's Channel. But as we mentioned there, we now move on to Edmund Ironside. And I think this really shows that even though you could get a bad king, his descendants might be good kings because they've all got good genetics. You know, the chances are every so often you're going to get a bad one, but you're also going to get very good ones, as we saw with Alfred the Great. So it's the genes that are so important here, because, you know, it has to just have been environment that actually turned Ethelred the way that he went, because Edmund Ironside is noted as pretty much being the opposite of Ethelred. And again, we'll look at Sharon Turner's quote here. He says, "At length, the scepter of the Anglo-Saxons came into the hands of a prince able to wield it with dignity to himself and prosperity to his people. Like Æthelstan, he was illegitimately born, but his spirit was full of energy, and his constitution was so hardy that he obtained the surname of Ironside. It was his misfortune that he attained the crown in a stormy season, and before his character and talents could be duly known or estimated, he had a conflict with a king perhaps greater than himself. Had Edmund, like his father, acceded to the crown of a tranquil, united and thriving nation, the abilities of a Canute might have been foiled. But Edmund succeeded to the care of a divided people, half of whose territory was in the occupation of his enemy. He had no interval of respite to recruit his strength or reform his country, and he was dishonourably killed in the full exertion of his abilities." And remember, at this point, Canute's gone back to Denmark, hasn't he? Because he wasn't able to rule at this time, and he's sort of gathering his army to come back. And half of England is already under the control of the Danelaw. And then you've got Edmund Ironside in the south. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, what you were saying about the genetics, the blood, that's exactly what Christ says, right? Where he says a good tree can't produce bad fruit and a bad tree can't produce good fruit. And many people don't realize he's talking about genetics, that, you know, you can always get a good person who might have a son who doesn't live up to him. But as you said, it as it continues, you're going to get good and bad, but the genetics are always good. And that's what he means with the tree. And yeah, it's a pity with Edmund, we never really see the man he really would have become. Perhaps he would have been another Alfred, but he died very young because of this war, right?
Yeah, it was a family line that was important as well throughout the generations. The king was seen as the representation of the same line, basically the same person. You might get a bad one, but most of the time they were good, and that was because of their genetics. And it was really the only king I think that was really seen as an individual as well. All the rest of them saw themselves as part of this group, part of their caste, part of the tribe, part of the nation, and they certainly wouldn't have seen themselves as individuals, as having been able to have thoughts different to what the king said, or do anything different to what the king said. That he was like the head of the nation that was leading them. Yeah, Patriarch, any thoughts on Edmund Ironside here?
Just to continue on, I guess, from what Truthvid said. So yeah, it's clearly obviously the genetics always has the potential, but it's the circumstances and environmental factors that refine and shape them genetics in order to fulfill the potential, or, you know, to or to just wallow in the more baser levels.
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? The potential is there, even if for one generation it doesn't get used to its fullest extent. It's still there in the next generation and can then be used to its fullest extent. It's that potential that is so important. But moving back to Wikipedia's quotes here. According to the Peterborough Chronicle manuscript, one of the major witnesses of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, early in September 1015, Canute came into Sandwich and straightaway sailed around Kent to Wessex until he came to the mouth of the Frome and harried in Dorset and Wiltshire and Somerset, beginning a campaign of intensity not seen since the days of Alfred the Great. A passage from Queen Emma's encomium provides a picture of Canute's fleet, saying, "There were so many kinds of shields that you could have believed that troops of all nations were present. Gold shone upon the prows. silver also flashed on the variously shaped ships, for who could look upon the lions of the foe, terrible with the brightness of gold, who upon the men of metal, menacing with golden face, who upon the bulls on the ships, threatening death, their horns shining with gold, without feeling any fear for the king of such a force. Furthermore, in this great expedition there was present no slave, no man freed from slavery, no low-born man, no man weakened by age, for all were noble, all strong with the might of mature age, all sufficiently fit for any type of fighting, all of such great fleetness that they scorned the speed of horsemen. So that's great praise indeed in that quote there. Wessex, long ruled by the dynasty of Alfred and Ethelred, submitted to Canute late in 1015, as it had to his father 2 years earlier. At this point, Edric Streona, the ealdorman of Mercia, deserted Ethelred, together with 40 ships and their crews, and joined forces with Canute. Another defector was Thorkell the Tall, a Yoms Viking chief, who had fought against the Viking invasion of Swain Forkbeard, with a pledge of allegiance to the English in 1012. Some explanation for this shift of allegiance may be found in a stanza of the Jomsborg Vikinga saga that mentions two attacks against Jomborg's mercenaries while they were in England, with a man known as Henningay, a brother of Thorkell, among their casualties. If the Flatjarbok is correct that this man was Canute's childhood mentor, it explains his acceptance of his allegiance with Jom Vikings, ultimately in the service of Jomsborg. The 40 ships Edric came with, often thought to be of the Danelaw, were probably Thorkell's. And I think this Edric is the same Edric that was responsible for beheading the princess, although I'm not certain. He seems to have the same name here. And it makes this point that he deserted Ethelred, and I think, or maybe it was Ironside by this time that was actually king. So maybe he was deserting Ironside by the time that we get to 1015 here. What do you make of what's being said here, Treefitz?
Yeah, I think that is Edric. He kept switching sides, right, for whoever would give him more. But I think here that the key thing is that Canute and the Vikings, they weren't seen as, you know, these evil heathen people. They were Christian people. And now, you know, if you join Canute, you're going to get rewarded. You're going to live comfortably. You know what I mean? Would you join the great heathen army? You know, many of people living in England wouldn't even think of that. But now Canute's a Christian king. Edmund's a Christian king. So what difference does it make? It's more just who gives them a greater advantage here, right? So it's a great change from the previous Viking invasion, right?
Yeah, and also I think what we've actually got here, we've got Ethelred is still alive as the king, but then we've got his son Edmund Ironside, which is here as well, still at this point. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Just that, you know, the fact that they were more swayed towards the comforts of life, I guess, and whoever that would give them the better life shows that there wasn't really such a strong influence from the native king. You know, that they didn't feel a sense of loyalty, that loyalty wasn't able to trump, you know, a better life elsewhere.
Well, that Edric seems like a right traitorous type, doesn't he? I mean, he was quite keen to be treacherous to the Danes and massacre the princess, behead the Danish princess. And then the next thing he does is he leaves Ethelred and takes 40 ships and goes off to fight for Canute. So, I mean, he really seems to have a bad character to me. He's not an honourable person at all. Well, early in 1016, the Vikings crossed the Thames and harried Warwickshire, while Edmund Ironside's attempts at opposition seemed to have come to nothing. The chronicler says the English army disbanded because the king and the citizenry of London were not present. The midwinter assault by Canute devastated its way northwards across eastern Mercia. Another summons of the army brought the Englishmen together, and they were met this time by the king. although it came to nothing as so often before, and Ethelred returned to London with fears of betrayal. Edmund then went north to join Uhtred, the Earl of Northumbria, and together they harried Staffordshire, Shropshire and Cheshire in western Mercia, possibly targeting the estates of Edric Streona. Canute's occupation of Northumbria meant Uhtred returned home to submit himself to Canute, who seems to have sent a Northumbrian rival, Thurbrand the Hold, to massacre Uhtred and his retinue. Ericir Harkonnenson, most likely with another force of Scandinavians, came to support Canute at this point, and the veteran Norwegian Jarl was put in charge of Northumbria, and Prince Edmund remained in London, still unsubdued behind its walls, and was elected king after the death of Ethelred on the 23rd of April 1016. So Ethelred was completely unable to unite his forces under him. As it says here, it came to nothing, as so often before, and then he goes back to London thinking that the people are going to betray him. Well, the truth is that he had already betrayed his people. He had betrayed all chivalry, all the basic understanding of honour and civilization in massacring these Danes and just setting a terrible example for his people. So he was the betrayer. He had betrayed his people. So, I mean, that's all he could expect. He wasn't going to be able to unite them. But obviously Edmund was a completely different character. Any thoughts on this, Truefids?
Yeah, you see that a weak king's going to really struggle to bring an army together because they know they're just going to be mincemeat, right? That they're only going to unite under a good, strong king. And you see here, especially what type of kingdom Edmund's inheriting. It's completely overrun. There's like the nobles are deserting him and joining Canute. So his chances are almost hopeless here now, right?
Yeah, and he's even got people from Mercia, Mercian kings that are going after him, that aren't even from the Danes. Everybody that can take a chance to have a go at this kingdom down there in the south, this Wessex kingdom, they're taking that chance, taking advantage of the fact that there's all this division within the kingdom at this point. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Just that you noticed quite a few recurring patterns and themes, don't you? When, you know, with the different rises and falls of certain kings, and you know, it's just paving the way for new, stronger leadership. You know, the weaker kind of vessels, I guess, get sifted out or, you know, weeded out, and then eventually you're left with the peoples that form the stronger bonds, and then them stronger bonds go on to build the better nation.
Yeah, we can see these recognisable patterns, can't we? When we look at history as a whole, instead of just looking at an individual and an individual's life, as we work our way through, we can see these repetitive patterns of not uniting together and then being weak. And when you're divided, another group can then come in and take over. And you're looking at the fortunes, basically, of the various different peoples, because we've had the Cymry now, or who sometimes get referred to as the Celts or the Britons, and then we've had the Romans, and then we've had the Saxons, and now we've got the Danes, and each one of those peoples has variously been in the ascendant at a certain point, and then they've fallen apart once they became divided, and once they became decadent. Really, and also some of these other factors played into it, like we were talking about before, with when the inheritance was split up between all the sons instead of just going to the firstborn son. Again, that just splits the kingdom up, and no one part is strong enough to repel the invaders, and then you just get taken over. And moving back to Sharon Turner, an important struggle ensued between Edmund and Canute for the possession of London. It was long besieged in vain, sometimes by a part of Canute's forces, sometimes by all. London was at this time defended on the south by a wall which extended along the river. The ships of Canute from Greenwich proceeded to London. The Danes built a strong military work on the south bank of the river and drew up their ships on the west of the bridge so as to cut off all access to the city. Edmund vigorously defended it a while in person, and when his presence was required elsewhere, the brave citizens made it impregnable. During the siege, Edmund fought two battles with the Danes in the country, one at Penn in Dorsetshire, and the other, the most celebrated, at Skirstan, about midsummer. So you can see that you've got these old tactics here of a siege, and you got this wall that was there. And I wonder if that wall is still there, or what the name of the wall was that extended along the river there. Because you've got various parts of London that are named after these famous kings, like Billingsgate. That was a king called Bell. Ludgate, that was another king called Lud. So I'm wondering what this wall was actually called. Any thoughts on this, Truthvids? Do you know anything about this wall that was extended along the river?
No, I'm not sure, but I was wondering that as well, because I remember at the south you had Ludgate, right? And that's right at the south of London, and it's known because obviously over the centuries London kept expanding, and they'd build a new wall to circumference it, and then get bigger, another wall, and of course now we don't have walls anymore. But yeah, that's certainly interesting, because a lot of the history, you can go, if someone says, oh, that king didn't exist, and then you go find the wall and say, well, the wall's still there, that is referenced during this time. So, who's that named after then, right?
Well, that's it. They named places after these kings so that we knew they existed. You've got lots of places in Wales that are named after people in history that people say, oh, no, they didn't exist. And that's what Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett do. They go back looking at these names of places, and they say, look, this is the place where this battle with King Arthur, this is where he fought this battle. And all the details of the battle are replicated in the names of the places in this area. So it was important that the names of places does hold importance. And you think today what they're doing is they're just changing the names of streets to be politically correct, and you're losing all the history that was there and why that street was named in that way in the first place, as if these names were just randomly put there in the past and we can just get rid of them and change them for something politically correct today. And it abolishes our history, basically. Patriarch, any thoughts on what's happening here?
I wonder if if there's any remnant of that wall that exists today at all. And also what I noticed is the meaning of constructing dikes. I know it's a bit of a crass term for a lesbian, but it kind of makes sense as to why they call it a dike, in terms of drying up the womb or, something which doesn't let the water flow.
Yeah, I think there's also that there's a tale of the boy who puts his finger in the dike, isn't there? This Dutch tale, I seem to remember from childhood, was to do with a dike. And the next bit we have is Wikipedia referring to what happened now. Canute returned southwards, and the Danish army evidently divided, some dealing with Edmund, who had broken out of London before Canute's encirclement of the city was complete, and he went to gather an army in Wessex, the traditional heartland of the English monarchy. Part of the Danish army besieged London, constructing dikes on the northern and southern flanks, and a channel dug across the banks of the Thames to the south of the city, enabling their longships to cut off any communications upriver. There was a battle fought at Pencilwood in Somerset, with a hill in Selwood Forest as the likely location, and a subsequent battle at Sherston in Wiltshire, which was fought over 2 days but left neither side victorious. Edmund was able to temporarily relieve London, driving the enemy away and defeating them after crossing the Thames at Brentford. Suffering heavy losses, he withdrew to Wessex to gather fresh troops, and the Danes again brought London under siege. But after another unsuccessful assault, they withdrew into Kent under attack by the English, with a battle fought at Otford. At this point, Edric Streona went over to King Edmund, and Canute set sail northwards across the Thames estuary to Essex, and went from the landing of the ships up the River Orwell to ravage Mercia. So again, we see this treasonous type, Edric Streona, going back over to King Edmund, and I don't think Edmund should have accepted him at this point, but apparently he did. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, it's just interesting that during Alfred's time, he was constructing fortresses and, using the land and all that to take advantage against the Danes, who didn't really seem to be building anything. They were just raiding and plundering. And here we have a complete difference where they're building, all siege works and moats. And, he's really got it organized. And I think this would really show you how the Christian civilization's kicking off. And, all the knowledge and the craft and where it's starting to settle and they're becoming more peaceful, you start to get all the other parts of civilization flourishing and they're becoming much more formidable in battle, right?
Yeah, this is a different tactics of battle that we're used to seeing with the Danes, aren't we? We're used to sort of just seeing these raiding parties, but now we're seeing them building up dikes, cutting off communication upstream, leaving one crowd there so that they can go off and attack in other parts of the country. You're starting to see a lot of strategy that's being employed now. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I think it also gives an insight into the long-term objectives. They're obviously investing more time, effort, and really saw it as conquering every bit of land that they kind of were taking at that point. It was they clearly had long-term intentions for that land.
Yeah, I mean, before it was just like raiding, take what you could, move on to another part of the country, raid that, burn everything, take what you could. And then from the time of Alfred the Great onwards, you had them starting to settle. And then by the time you get to this point, you've got them wanting to build an empire. And you've got settled Danes in the north of the country. Of course, they're all massacred in the south in this horrible massacre. But yeah, they're farming. And they're starting to live on the land, and they've been there for a certain amount of time now as well, 150 years, I guess. Moving back to what Sharon Turner has to say, Edmund selected the bravest soldiers for his first line of attack and placed the rest as auxiliary bodies. Then, noticing many of them individually, he appealed to their patriotism and their courage with that fire of eloquence which rouses man to mighty deeds. I do like the way Sharon Turner writes. He conjured them to remember their country, their beloved families, and paternal habitations. For all these they were to fight, for all these they would conquer. To rescue or to surrender these dear objects of their attachments would be the alternative of that day's struggle. His representations warmed his soldiers, and in the height of their enthusiasm, he bade the trumpets to sound and the charge of battle to begin. Eagerly, his brave countrymen rushed against their invaders and were nobly led by their heroic king. And that's interesting, where you had these trumpets blasting. You wonder what the sort of sounds of the battle would be like the clashing of swords and axes, battle axes into shields. But then you've also got musicians here blasting away on the trumpets as well. I should imagine trying to raise the spirits of their side. He quitted his royal station to mingle in the first ranks of the fight. And yet, while his sword strewed the plain with slaughter, his vigorous mind watched eagerly every movement of the field. He struggled to blend the duty of commander and the gallant bearing of a soldier. Edric and two other generals with the men of Wiltshire and Somerset aided Canute. On Monday, the first day of the conflict, both armies fought with unprevailing courage, and mutual fatigue compelled them to separate. In the morning, the awful struggle was renewed. In the midst of the conflict, Edmund forced his way to Canute and struck at him vehemently with his sword. The shield of the Dane saved him from the blow, but it was given with such strength that it divided the shield and cut the neck of the horse below it. A crowd of Danes then rushed upon Edmund, and after he had slain many, he was obliged to retire. Canute was but slightly wounded, and while the king was thus engaged, Edric struck off the head of one Osmir, whose countenance resembled the king's, and raising it on high, exclaimed to the Anglo-Saxons that they fought to no purpose. "Fly, ye men of Dorset and Devon, fly and save yourselves. Here is your Edmund's head." The astonished English gazed in terror. The king was not then visible, for he was piercing the Danish centre. Edric was believed, and panic began to spread through every rank. At this juncture, Edmund appeared, receding before the pressure of the Danes who had rescued Canute. He saw the malice and sent his spear as his avenger. Edric shunned the point and it pierced two men near him. But his presence was now unavailing. In vain, he threw off his helmet and, gaining an eminence, exposed his disarmed head to undeceive his warriors. But the fatal spirit had gone forth, and before its alarms could be counteracted, the army was in flight. All the bravery and skill of Edmund could only sustain the combat until night interposed. So, have a wonderful description of this. Of this battle here, and at this point Edric is still on the side of Canute. That's what I was saying. I cannot understand how Edmund could accept Edric back afterwards. But yeah, lots of points here. Treefid, do you want to pick up on any of the points in this battle here?
Yeah, a few points. Firstly, Sharon Turner, he was a solicitor, right? So he was very well educated and could write well. You can see that in the writing here. But I think what Patriarch was saying earlier, you know, how were they just generals or were they fighting? It seems that they were expected to kind of not be at the forefront. You know, you don't want to just charge in and die, because you can see what happens. Their whole army panics. But here, Edmund, he's so enthusiastic. He wants to really energetically lead his army, and he's actually charging in at the front. And where we described how Canute was, you know, a huge man, strongly built. Well, here Edmund's actually, you know, going hand to hand, and he's almost killed him. So Edmund must have been a large guy, right? I can only imagine he was big and strong as well to cut through Canute's shield where it's cut in half, and almost cutting the head off the horse as well at the same time, right? That's a really strong guy. And then he picks up a spear and launches it at Edric, and Edric jumps out the way and he kills two men, or at least pierces two men with one spear. You know, that's definitely not like a weak guy who you're imagining leading the army, right?
Well, he must have also felt really triumphant after splitting the shield of Canute, and I guess like after that the word would have got around, and Edric could see that was going to happen. So straight away he kills someone else and pretends that it was Edmund that has been attacked. So, I mean, even though he's a really treasonous person, he's also quite quick thinking, isn't he? Because he doesn't want the troops to be his like the side he's fighting on. He doesn't want the troops to become demoralized by what's just happened with Canute. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
I guess they would have been heavily demoralized once they saw the head. You know, because often the king and the leader is the one that pretty much sustains their morale, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that was the point, wasn't it? He managed to switch it around, because it would have been Canute's side that would have been demoralised by the shield splitting, but he jumps in there and he holds up this head that looks like the king on the other side, Edmund's head, so it ends up being the Saxons that end up being demoralised. When rightfully, it should have been the Danes that were demoralised after that. Where the difficulty of the battle disinclined Canute from renewing it. He left the contested field at midnight and marched afterwards to London to his shipping, and the morning revealed his retreat to Edmund. The perfidious Edric, discerning the abilities of the king, made use of his relationship and early connection, and he had actually married Edmund's sister and had been his foster father, and due to this early connection, he was able to obtain a reconciliation, and Edmund consented to receive him on his oath of fidelity. And I think that was a mistake. I mean, this guy is a real traitor, and he killed this other guy, this Osric, I think his name was, Osmir, and pretending that was actually Edmund that he had killed, you know, just that day, less than 12 hours earlier. He's been fighting on the side of his enemies. He took 40 ships with him to go and fight with Canute, and yet Edmund receives him on his oath. I guess you could say that Edmund was honourable, and this Edric had shown that he was not honourable, though. So I don't think Edmund really had to do that. Perhaps he was like really playing on the family connection as well, saying that he'd been his foster father. And I'm assuming that that's probably something to do with a Christian reference when somebody gets baptized. Because, no, it wasn't, because he was illegitimate, wasn't he? Edmund Ironside was an illegitimate son of Ethelred. So perhaps he had actually been brought up by Edric, with Edric and his mother. And that was why he was his foster father. So, I mean, it could be that that was his stepfather, which sort of introduces all sorts of complications into it, doesn't it? Truefids, what are your thoughts on this? What do you know about this Edric and that he was Edmund's foster father here?
I don't know much about that, but that would make sense, right? Because Ethelred, his father, was always running away at the first sign of battle. So, you know, it's possible. And that's how he was able to get to him. Look, I'm married to your sister. I helped raise you. Your dad was a terrible king. So that's why I sided. But with Canute, I can see, you know, there's something in you. You're like Alfred. Let me join you. And, you know, together we'll drive out these Danes. And Edmund must have, you know, fallen for it, right?
Yeah. So he married Edmund's sister, but he must have been much, much older as well. And obviously he was also friends with Ethelred. He was trusted by Ethelred because he carried out that attack against the Danes. Pedro, any thoughts on what's just happened here?
I think there would have likely been a lot of, you know, family ties, you know, even amongst the, you know, the sort of frontline forces. You know, they would have had cousins and that migrated long over before. So it would have been quite a difficult situation, wouldn't it, for them in general. I'd have thought that a lot of this stuff would have been going on, wouldn't it?
Yeah, blood is always thicker than water as well. Although this guy wasn't actually related to him, he had married his sister and he'd effectively been a father to him because he was an illegitimate son. And even though he was illegitimate, although he was then made into king, Edmund Ironside was, that sort of says that the Saxons had the same laws as the Welsh, didn't they? Because the Welsh said an illegitimate son could inherit his father's estate if the father had acknowledged him, even though he was illegitimate. So what must have happened here is that Ethelred must have acknowledged Edmund was his son, even though he was illegitimate. And that's why he could claim that inheritance and lawfully be king. Continuing with Sharon Turner here. When Edmund withdrew to Wessex, Canute passed into Essex and thence advancing plundered Mercia without mercy. Edmund, earnest for a decisive effort, again assembled all the strength of England and pursued the Dane, who was retiring to his ships with his plunder. At Asandun, in the north part of Essex, the armies met. Edmund arranged this countrymen into three divisions, and riding around every rank, he roused them by his impressive exhortations to remember their own valour and their former victories. He entreated them to protect the kingdom from Danish avarice, and to punish, by a new defeat, the enemies they had already conquered. Canute brought his troops gradually into the field. Edmund made a general and impetuous attack. His vigour and skill again brought victory to his arms. The star of Canute was clouded when Edric, his secret ally, deserting Edmund in the very hour of success, fled from the field with the men of Radnor and all the battalions he commanded. The charge of Canute on the exposed and inferior Anglo-Saxons was then decisive. The valour of Edmund was forgotten. Flight and destruction overspread the plain. A few, jealous of their glory and anxious to give a rallying point to the rest, fought desperately amidst surrounding enemies and were all cut off but one man. In this dismal conflict, the flower of the nobility of England perished. So that's really tragic. But some people look at that and say, well, the Saxons did the same to the Welsh, didn't they? The flower of the nobility of the Welsh, the Saxons murdered. But this was done on the battlefield, and it was all brought about by treachery, by this Edric. Again, I mean, he's just got to have the lowest character of all, I think, this Edric person. What do you make of what's just happened here, Truefitz?
Yeah, well, that's why they say once a traitor, always a traitor, right? That if someone betrays someone or how long until they betray you, right? But obviously, as we're going to get to later, Knut has that same fault, right? So, but yeah, perhaps this is also why Edmund chased him, because he thought, well, if I've got this Edric with me and all his men, then I can take Knut, you know. And he didn't realize that Edric was going to betray him. And had he not accepted Edric, maybe he wouldn't have had the men yet to chase Knut, and he would have had to, you know, just let Knut maintain the other half of the kingdom, right?
Well, I think Knut should have looked at it as well and said, well, if this guy is a traitor to his own people, how much less of a connection does he have to my people? How much less loyalty is he going to have to me if he's a traitor to his own people? But in the end, it turns out that he was loyal to Knut and just a traitor to his own people. I guess we still have spies today, don't we, that go and spy for the opposite side, that will go and spy for Russia or whatever, and spy for the Soviets, and vice versa, people that were in the Soviets that would spy for the West. What do you make of what's just happened here, Patriarch?
I think it kind of sheds a bit of insight into the character and leader's tactics. So, you know, whereas Edmund was more of an impulsive attack, and we see the Canute, you know, brings his troops in gradually to assess the situation. It just highlights the character and strength of character, and ultimately, you know, why Canute came out on top.
Well, continuing with Sharon Turner here, the betrayed Edmund disdained the death of despair and attempted new efforts to rescue his afflicted country. He retired to Gloucester, and such was his activity and eloquence that a fresh army was around him before Canute overtook him. Edmund then challenged Canute to decide their quarrel by a single combat. Some authorities assert that they fought, others that Canute declined the meeting. But the result was that a pacification was agreed upon between the princes, and England was divided between them. Canute was to reign in the north and Edmund in the south. The rival princes exchanged arms and garments, and the money for the fleet was agreed upon, and the armies separated. But the brave Edmund did not long survive the pacification. He perished the same year. The circumstances attending his assassination are variously given. Malmesbury mentions that two of his chamberlains were seduced by Edric to wound him at a most private moment with an iron hook, but he states this to be only rumour. The king's violent death and its author are less reservedly avowed by others, and the northern accounts go even further. The Knicklinger saga and Saxo carry up the crime as high as Canute. They expressly state that Edric was corrupted by Canute to assassinate Edmund. I don't think Canute corrupted Edric. I think Edric was just corrupt right from the start, because he was happy to murder the Danish princess, behead the Danish princess, and then he was happy to leave his rightful king and then go over and fight for Canute, and then he goes back to Edmund and basically turns tail again. I mean, the guy was just a traitor right from the start. I don't think Canute corrupted him, but this is really sad, because obviously they're quite noble, aren't they? But you can say both of these kings are noble, Edmund Ironside and Canute, and they get to this point here where they're going to have a trial by single combat, and then they say, well, that will leave one of us dead, so we might as well split the country between us. You have the north, I'll have the south. Both armies have fought valiantly, both kings have fought absolutely valiantly, and then there's just this stain that is put upon it by this arch traitor, Edric. What are your thoughts on this, Truefids? And have you got any final thoughts for the day as well?
Yeah, it's a sad end to Edmund, because we never really got to see what type of king he would have been. Would he have become like an Alfred, you know, because obviously he's had this harsh upbringing, the constant war. So you imagine that he would have been, a good king. You know, after all this, he didn't have all the vices of Ethelred, you know, his father. But it's sad how it ended. But yeah, I think what you said as well, I don't think Edric needed to be corrupted. I think he would have happily assassinated Edmund on some kind of reward from Canute, right? So, you know, unfortunately, that's just the way it is, right?
It's a bit of a smear on Canute, really, these saga writers, the Knickling Saga and Saxo Grammaticus, he writes the history of Denmark. So they're smearing Canute, really, by saying that, you know, the orders for this came from Canute. Thoughts on this, Patriarch? And have you got any thoughts to round off the day with?
Yeah, well, it was noble of him, wasn't it, Canute, to, you know, divvy up the lands. He probably could have pushed and claimed it all for himself. But maybe he kind of foresaw that, you know, there would still be an ongoing, continuous war for the peoples that felt Edmund was the rightful heir. So in this way, you know, with a joint rule that, you know, everyone would have been kept happy. And I guess because it was populated largely by, you know, the native Britons and the Danes by this point.
Yeah, if he'd have carried on, he would have then had a battle for hearts and minds, and also you'd have ended up with just masses of dead. All the best people, all the best fighters on both sides would have ended up being slaughtered. And I mean, he had to go back and rule the countries that he'd come from as well. So in the end, it was the pragmatic thing to do, I think. And also it shows us that they still had trial by single combat. Trial by mortal combat was still going at this point. Anyway, we'll get into more about King Canute and what happens after King Canute becomes the ruler of England in the next episode. Thank you very much for coming on today, Truthvids.
Thanks for having me, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thank you, Sven.
And thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with another patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.